on us notes, Mr. Cassidy, for about 3 months. Maybe I can do that next time.
This is a down on the Yukon Historical Society. Their meeting of September the 27th, and our speaker is Sister Hubert, and she will now take over.
Sit down and tell us your whole life. This is your life, you might say.
My life and time. It's strange the way life comes to a full circle. And when I was, quite young, I wasn't a professed sister yet. It came for me in this way. We were out on a picnic, all the sisters, and I ate a piece of candy that was too hard for me, and so sprung the jaw and had to be taken to the hospital for some deep therapy treatments. And the sister in charge of the department was very busy, and they forgot to send up my slip down at the office, so she said to me, what is your name, my little sister? And I said, I'm Sister Vashon. And she said, where are you from? And I said, I was born in Fairbanks. I remember lying on my face, you know, and I heard this little gasp above me. And she said, and your father's name? And I said, John. And with that, she reached down and picked me up, and she said, oh, my dear, you were my first baby case in Fairbanks. Well, we had our own little powwow. My father's name was John Vashon. He was a French-Canadian out of St. Raymond, Quebec. A wonderful person, even if he was my own father. Happy-go-lucky, generous, a man of deep faith. He could do anything, play any kind of a musical instrument. He was a genius with sleight-of-hand tricks. A wonderful storyteller, and a man with a heart as big as he was. He also had diabetes. Louise McLellan was my mother. She was a Scotch-Irish woman from Boston. John asked Louise to marry him when they were 18. I have pictures I'll show you here of them. And because of financial problems in the home, Louise had to say no, she couldn't. So he got mad. He also had a temper of his own, and he joined the gold rush with Peter Vashon, his older brother. And they went into the Klondike, and John was at Chilkoot Pass when the slide occurred, and he helped dig out bodies there. When they got into Dawson, Peter was more interested in making money, selling, kind of a middleman. John got onto the fire department. He was captain of the fire department at Dawson City. And about 8 years later, he came back to Boston, and Louise hadn't married yet. So this time, they were married in 1905. Well, he took her from Boston, Massachusetts, all the way to the top of the world. Grandfather said to her, my God, John, get her a good dog, won't you? So they were in a Dawson. Well, they were there 5 years and four babies. And then John bought a homestead in Alaska. Mother was, she had just had the last baby, a little girl, Margaret Louise. There was Hayden and Otis, Mary Josephine and Margaret Louise. So they moved in the summer of 1910 into the heart of Alaska, at a homestead at the junction of the Tanana and the Tolovana Rivers. It's about 75 miles from Fairbanks. It was a good spot. There were buildings on the land. It was a roadhouse where people stopped on the trail from Fairbanks down to Tanana, and things looked well for them. In October of 1910, the mail service, it was in the winter time, there was snow on the ground, the mail had just left, and Mother was sitting down at the breakfast table with somebody, I don't know who, was some guest, and she heard someone call fire. And she ran outdoors to see the building in flames coming from the room where the babies were sleeping. The It took four men to hold her, to keep her from going in. My father was hauling water from the river, and he went back in and into this inferno and gathered up the bodies. The oldest boy was four, Hayden, and he told me about 3 years ago, he remembers waking up with this coughing of the smoke, and he got out of bed and lost consciousness at the top of the stairs. So he was low enough so that he got air, but he was unconscious for quite a while. The other three little ones were dead. The baby was about 6 months old. Well, there was a telegraph station about a quarter of a mile from Tolavana Trading Post, and of course this was all wired into Fairbanks, and Peter Vachon and Dr. Poole came down to meet Johnny Vachon. They met him at Minto. Johnny Campbell was in charge of Minto then. And his head and hands were very, very badly burned. Mother said that he had a ring on that, of course, when he took his gloves off, his hand just swelled terribly, and this ring was cutting him. And he asked somebody to file it off, and this man said, "Oh, I can't do it." So Mother had to file the ring off and walk the floor, and all his hair came off inside his cap. These are pretty gory things, but when he took his cap off, his hair was inside there. So he was taken up to Fairbanks up here, and the sisters swathed him in bandages, and the little bodies were brought up. I have the clipping that appeared in the, I think it's one of the Boston papers, but it's a reprint of the Alaska Citizen, the Fairbanks Alaska Citizen, and it tells of the funeral of these little, my little brothers and sisters. The pallbearers were Frank Gordon, Max Smith, and J.S. Sterling. Each of them carried a little casket. And there were 16 little girls that carried lilies and preceded the pallbearers and the little caskets in. Father Cremont said the mass, and he was assisted by Father Monroe. And then it names the ladies who sang in the choir, Mrs. Caskey and Mrs. Moffat. And this article keeps speaking of my father as Captain Vachon. Of course, he never quite got over the fact he was captain of the fire department in Dawson City. What shall I tell you next? Let's see. Well, it took 3 days to go from Fairbanks down to Tolavana. Usually, the trip was made in the wintertime by double ender. You all know what a double ender is? It's a sled. The back part of it is it's loose. It'll sway. The back's runners. There are evidently four runners, as I remember it, and the back runners shift. And there were two horses that pull this, and usually a driver. The only driver I remember was called Red. And the driver went down to Tanana and then came back, usually within the week. So we had a pretty good mail service when they could get through. We had the post office at Tolavana. I remember Tolavana. I was about 8 when I left it. I remember Tolavana as having a roadhouse, which was our place. And in that was a general store, and of course the eating and sleeping quarters for the guests, and our own home. Then there was an Indian village about a quarter of a mile one direction, and the Signal Corps telegraph station a quarter of a mile the other direction. Mother often said she couldn't have stayed there without the telegraph station. Well, the three Vachon boys set up business, a fur business. Andrew in Tanana, he had the Tanana Commercial Company down there, and he bought furs from the natives. My father at Tolavana set up a Fox Farm, and he bought pelts from the Indians too. And Peter was the agent. He dealt in the furs with the old Hudson's Bay Company in Seattle. The Fox Farm was, it wasn't extensive. I would say at the most we had about 12 female foxes. And my father and some of the Indians built this. Now, if I can describe it to you, if you can think of a huge box and 12 smaller boxes inside it. Now the big box, the otter box, was a cage they dug 6 feet down in the earth and laid chicken wire all over this big area that would be the bottom of the box. Then they shoveled all the earth back on top of it and then laid more chicken wire on top of that and another layer of earth. Then each of the little boxes was another little more chicken wire up to make the sides of the cage, and the big box, can you follow me, was another cage. So there, each fox was within two cages, and no fox could dig itself out. They might get through the first layer of chicken wire, but they'd have to work pretty hard to get to that second one, 6 feet down. We had cross foxes. My father always wanted a red fox, and there was a male fox that used to sniff around the cages, but we never were able to catch it. And of course, regularly he, I never knew how, I can't remember how he killed them. I don't remember. But I can see him yet at night skinning these animals. He'd hang them up by the back feet, and then he'd just skin with a little, very, very small and very sharp pen knife that he worked with very carefully, and he'd skin them, and then stretch the pelts inside out on boards that looked like what we might call a sleeve ironing board now, something about that size and that long. Peter Vachon married the daughter of the postmaster in Fairbanks. His name was Crum, I think, C-R-U-M-M, and her name was Carol, Miss Carol Crum, a very beautiful and very talented woman. Sang very well in the Episcopalian choir. Eva McGowan knows Carol. And Peter's job was then to make contact with the buyers for these pelts. One time in, Father had quite a time getting this fur farm started. First of all, where was he going to get a live vixen, you know, for his farm? So he asked the Indians he said he'd pay them well for any live female that they brought in and for a male. And little by little he managed to get them. He asked them when the female gave birth to the litter, and they told him some crazy date, like say April, which was way off. So he had to really learn by trial and error. So they realized that this was really cutting their throats, this business that Johnny was starting. And Chief Alexander, the chief of the village, called a meeting of all the leaders of this tribe, I guess you'd call it, to come to his village, and I guess they were going to decide just what they do about this. Well, Father always had very good relations with these Indians. We didn't have any of this script or anything. And Christmas, he always gave them presents, and Mother took care of them that were sick, and those that were sick. So here he was now faced with this business of the Indians balking him. So one day, he came into the store and took a handful of carpet tacks and tossed them in his mouth, and Mother said, "Johnny, where are you going?" And he said, "Oh, I'm going down to the village." And he rummaged around and took a 4-inch spike with him, and she said, "Now, you be careful." And he said, "Mm-hmm." So he went down to this big meeting was going on down the Indian village, and they were all the big chiefs were sitting on the floor of this house, little house down there, and Johnny went in. You didn't have to say anything. You just sat down. And he pushed a couple aside and sat down. And Alexander was sitting just about where you are, at the head of this thing. And Johnny was right across from him. So Johnny played with this big spike, played and played, and dropped it a couple times until he was sure that every man sitting in the circle saw it. And finally he said, "You see big nail?" Mm-hmm. They didn't say too much. Mm-hmm. Father said, "Well, I swallow him and make a lot of little nails." Alexander just looked at him, and there was just a murmur went around the room. So Father, with a great deal of sleight of hand, swallowed this nail, and then he sat. And they all looked at him. Very definitely looked him. Pretty soon he went, one carpet tag. Well, he hiccuped. He made about 8 little carpet tags. And with every one, he put it right in front of him on the floor until the 8 of them were out. And then he looked at all the men around the circle and got up and left. And as he left, Alexander said, "No, Johnny, no, bad medicine." Well, they figured it was better to help a man with that much bad medicine than to work against it. So they helped him get his pocket started. Every year in about this time, maybe a little earlier, Father used to take a group of them out, the Indians out, to do his hunting for the meat, for the winter's meat. And he always gave them a share, his hunters a share of the meat that was taken. Well, this year, both the Indians came back without my father. And Justin, mother said, "Where's Johnny?" And Justin just shook his head. Justin loved my mother, I'll have to tell you about that too. Just shook his head. And mother went out and looked around. Father was always playing some kind of a trick. And she looked in the rain barrel and she looked around the houses, and Johnny wasn't there. And pretty soon she came back and she said, "Justin, where is Johnny?" And Justin said, "I'm sorry for you that Johnny, he's lost." Well, Johnny was gone all night long. And the next morning, about 10 o'clock, he came in mad as anything. Mad. He said, he told those two Indians, "Now, they separated." He said, "Now, when you see duck, you whistle." Mm-hmm. Whistle. Mm-hmm. So they separated, and Father never heard a whistle. The Indians couldn't whistle. So he was lost. It came dark, came, and he was lost. And, oh, he was mad. He could have killed him. So mother said, "What are you going to do?" And he said, "I'll fix him. I'll fix him." Well, they're curious, you know, and simple people. And they came back about noontime to see if Johnny was back. And he was sitting there. He rolled a cigarette. He was sitting there with his chair back against the wall, rolling a cigarette. And nothing was said for a while. And Alexander said, "Johnny, where you sleep last night?" Father said, "Alexander, last night I sleep in empty bear stand." Well, you know, nobody slept in an empty bear's den unless he had the very special protection of a very, very fierce and very terrible forest demon. So Johnny was a very powerful man. Let's see now. Oh, the babies are buried out here in the cemetery. Right? Mother was always very thrilled between the priest's and the sister's graves. And Johnny is buried in the same grave. He died in 1920, and he's put in the same grave with the little babies, his little children. Peter died in 1942, I think. This is the little clipping about him. Well, after the fire in 1910, Johnny and Louise and the little boy went right back to Toldana, the same spot, and built another roadhouse and trading post a little farther from the river. And the first house was log, of course, and it had a kind of a gabled roof, and it was chinked with moss, caribou moss in it. Then the inside was papered with layers of newspaper and a layer of cheesecloth, and layers of newspaper and a layer of cheesecloth. Layers of them. So mother said that there was a table with a lamp on it, and the heat from the lamp must have ignited that chinking, and it must have been smoldering for days before it finally broke out in the bedroom and the little ones were lost. So in 1911, mother made a trip into Fairbanks, and on November 26th, I was born. And I was named Mary Louise after my two sisters, Mary Josephine and Margaret Louise, who were dead. Dr. Sutherland was the doctor who delivered me, and I don't remember the nurse's name. It's someplace on the records there at St. Joseph Hospital. I've seen them. Mother was in the hospital a month, 5 days waiting for me, and then, of course, I had to be a little older than newborn when I went back. But I was there a month. I mean, Mother was there a month, and the baby was born, and I was there, and my older brother was there. And the bill was $200. Now, I told you that at Tolavena, there was a telegraph station under the direction of the Signal Corps men, and the man in charge a couple of times was a Major McFarland, and he was a widower. He had 7 children outside in a home, an orphan home. And the boys at the telegraph station were just like one of the family. They'd come down and play cards, and when it was too cold up there, they'd bring down all their equipment and set it up in the store, and they'd sleep down at our place. And it was. So McFarland knew the Vachons very well, and was terribly grieved about this fire. So in 1911, he was back stationed at the Tolavena station. And when I was 3 weeks old, Mother, she's going to go back for Christmas Eve. She's going to be back with Johnny for Christmas Eve. And it was 60 below zero. And they got a clothes basket, and the sisters lined it with, well, I can see it yet, all blue, for a little girl, blue, okay. All lined with silk and cotton batting and that. And this mail sled came to the hospital door, and Father Monroe came out, and he said, "Mrs. Vachon, won't you reconsider taking that baby out in this weather?" And she said, "Father, you just go back and say Mass for us. It'll be all right." So Hayden, the little 5-year-old, was sitting at this end of the sled, and she was at the other end with this basket under this against her here. And she said she kept her hand on the baby's face, knowing that as long as her hand was comfortable, the baby was warm enough. And then she lifted the blanket regularly to let air in for the little one. Well, it was 3 days down, and she said, Minto, Johnny Campbell's place was the first stop from our place into Fairbanks, but I don't know what the other one was, the second stop. But she said at that stop, she got out the dishpan and got the stuff ready to bathe the baby, and she said all these hardened old prospectors, you know, and old mule skinners stood around watching this little bit of humanity. You wouldn't guess it now. And she said, one of them said to her, "By golly, Miss Vachon, you tell John to take care of you. He'll never duplicate you." And he never tried. Well, we got down to Tolavana Christmas Eve, as she promised. And, of course, Johnny was waiting at the telegraph station. So while he was busy kissing my mother, Major McFarland yanked the covers back and saw the new baby. And Major McFarland later became my stepfather. And he said, "Oh, honey, I saw you before your own father did." Oh, let's see, no. I have 2 sisters younger than myself. Frances, who was born in Fairbanks in 1913, and Rita, who was born in 1915, but Father sent Mother out to Boston for the baby's birth. She needed some repair work done, and my aunt was a nurse, and so she went back to Boston, and she took all of us back with her. Hayden, by this time, was about 8, so he stayed back in Boston with Grandmother and went to school back there, and then all of us bundled up and went back to Alaska. Now, let's see, I want to tell you something about Fairbanks as I remember it. There was a Mrs. Baker who had a little restaurant. I think it was on 2nd Street. And right across from it was one of these real funny old catch-all stores. Even then, Dad Ellis ran it. And you could buy anything in that store. If you couldn't find anyplace else, the MC didn't have it. Dad Ellis had it. It may be all dirty and dusty, but it was there. Dr. and Mrs. LeBlanc were very, very good friends of ours. Mrs. Slippering was a very good Frank Gordon and the Prestons. The sisters that we knew were Sister Robert. She was a superior. Sister Arcadius and Sister Jules. Oh, there's a wonderful story to tell about her. I remember when Sister Jules came through. She came in. She was brand new, just professed, just took her vows, first vows. And she came from Montreal. Didn't know very much French, English. And they, for some reason or other, they must have come down Yukon and by our place, because it was on a boat that they came by. And we had little Pomeranian puppies. Well, this little young girl from Montreal, just probably lonesome as heck, you know, and this little dog, this little Pomeranian dog, she just loved it, just loved it. And my father said to Mother Alexander, who was her traveling companion, he said, well, Mother, if Sister would like to have this little dog, we'd love to give it to her. And Mother Alexander was very gruff. She says, oh, you don't want a little dog. What do you want a little dog for? And Miss Jules says, oh, Mother, please, please, Mother, can I have the little dog? And my mother said, well, of course you can have the little dog. Sure you can have it. So Mother Alexander let her take the little dog. Well, and it's written right in our rule that we don't have these little pets, you know. But Mother Alexander softened and let this poor little young sister have the dog. So here she lands in Fairbanks with a little dog on her arm. And Sister Robert says, huh, when did the Sister of Providence come on mission with a little dog? So she couldn't keep it. So they found a family here in town and gave the little dog to her. Well, the rest of the nuns went down to Dad Ellis's shop down here, and they found a little dog on wheels about this high, a little black furry dog. And Sister Jewel said she'd be going down the hall with a tray, and she'd see this little dog looking around the corner again. And she'd hide it, and they'd find it. Find it again. And one day she got real mad, and she kicked it. And it went way down the hall and fell against something and broke its jaw. So they took it to the surgery and bound it all up. And the next day it was right back looking at her. Well, the poor little puppy got mean and old, and finally they had to put away. I guess these little Pomeranians get, you know, snappish. You see, off and on we'd be in Fairbanks. And, our life was bound up very much with the church, with the sisters, with the priests. I remember, spending more time playing hide-and-go-seek under the superior's desk at St. Joseph Hospital, that I'm right where I belong, I assure you. Now, I told you that there was an Indian that loved my mother. Well, his name, there was Big Justin and Little Justin, and Little Justin was really the younger of the two. And one day, they came to the store regularly about three or four times a week and just stood around and smoked, and it took them half a day to decide to buy a nickel's worth of, or 25 cents worth of candy. You didn't sell anything under 25 cents. That was the smallest piece of exchange. Then they'd go home, maybe. So one day, Justin stood around, and finally he said to my mother, what's the matter with you? Why don't you leave that Johnny and come live with me? Well, Mother said, well, it wasn't very romantic, but it was a proposal. She held that over his head a long time. The river boats stopped at Tolavana for wood and supplies and that sort of thing. The last boat always brought in the staples for the year. Oh, there was flour and vegetables. Always a case of oranges, a case of lemons, a case of grapefruit, and a case or two of eggs. And by the time they were unloaded on the bank, they were very badly spoiled. So the first thing that Father always did was to locate those three cases and open them and corral the three girls and make them sort out this fruit. And Mother would cut out the good part of the fruit and make a marmalade that we just loved. So this day we were working, and Frances, my little sister, she said, I think I'd rather have marmalade, she said. So she was putting good oranges into this basin that we were supposed to put the spoiled ones in. And Mother said, what's the matter now? She said, these are good oranges. No, Frances said, I'd rather have your marmalade. Mother was real pleased about that. Then there was a case of eggs that were, you know, bad, so that had to be sorted, but we didn't get that job. This hired man had it, and I can see him this day sorting off the eggs. And we went by, and he said something very foolish. He said, now don't step in that basin of eggs. Well, you know, I stepped in the basin of eggs, and they were very bad. So what I did, the other two did.
Oh.
And, he was furious. So he called my mother, and we all knew what was coming. So I ran out the store in around the yard, and the other two followed me. Rita, the baby, was about, she must have been about three, I guess. And we didn't know where to hide. Mother, we knew Mother Bess was a switch. We didn't know where to hide. So we ran around and looked and looked, and there was a tent that Father had used for storage of something. And it had a hole in it for a stovepipe, you know. Well, we got in the tent and realized we couldn't see what Mother was doing. So I said to Rita, look, I'll hold you up, and you stick your head out that hole, and then tell us what's going on. So I boosted Rita up, and she got her head through, and she says, oh, gee, kids, here she comes. She's got a big switch. Well, with that, I dropped her. And here she hung with her head yelling and crying and screaming as if she'd been butchered. Well, my mother was just scared. She went in, and she quit her a little bit and unhooked her baby. Then she went out, and the rest of us really got it. Hanging our little sister. There are many, many other stories like that I could tell you about my family. There was a great warm love in the family, very warm, because of the three that had been lost. Anytime we were lost, Mother always ran and looked in the river. Of all dumb places to look, she'd never see us in the Tolavana. But she went and looked anyway. In 1925, Johnny died. We moved into Fairbanks as the last year of his life. Insulin had not been discovered at this time, and he had to live on a terrible diet. Terrible diet. It was very hard for him to see us eating the food that he couldn't eat. It was then, I think I must have been about this... No, 1920 he died. I must have been about the second grade. I was about eight. And I went to Maine school. I can't remember who my teacher was. She was a very lovely young woman. And at this time we lived on Front Street. It was called Front Street then. Across the street from the Episcopal Church, is that St. Matthew's down there on First? It was down there. So I remember that church bell used to ring for evening services at 7:15 on Sunday night, and Father Monroe had a benediction up at Immaculate Conception at 7:30. So Mother used to know when to go to the Catholic Church by the Episcopal Church bell. Incidentally, the statue in the front of the Catholic Church was donated by Uncle Peter. And once he donated the statue, Peter thought he had done enough. And poor old Father Monroe, desperate for money, you know, and Peter seeming to have enough of it, Father Monroe would say, Peter, haven't you got something you could give us? And Peter just stand and look up at the statue. And that was the answer. Oh, golly. Well, after Father died, Mother took us all back to Boston. I think Father died in March, and we left in September, went back. Mother told me later that Peter and Andrew, the other two brothers, walked the floor trying to get her to consent to burn down the establishment at Tolavana for the insurance on it. And she kept saying, I can't do that. I can't. Johnny wouldn't do this. I can't do it. So one day before we left, she came to us and she said, you know, girlies, Tolavana caught fire and burned. And we said, oh, maybe somebody was careless with the window curtains. And she said, maybe that was it. But now we pretty well know who lit it. So we went back to Boston, and I went to school back there and became acquainted with my brother, who by this time was so spoiled from grandmother, he had quite a time adjusting to his three little sisters. And a year to the day that my father died, my stepfather began to wire, or the man was to be my stepfather, Major McFarlane, began to wire Mother proposals every day. The telephone would ring, and Mother would flutter to the telephone, and this telegram would come, and she'd come back all pink and smiling. We didn't know what it was all about. And finally the telegram said, hurry up, this is getting expensive. So she sent a telegram back that said, yes, we'll be leaving, we'll be in Seward on June 21st. And there was a gasp at the other end of the line, and the girl who was taking this said, oh, Mrs. Basham, she said, could I ask you a favor? And Mother said, well, yes. And she said, you know, the girls down here have been following this little romance.
and we'd love to meet you. Won't you come down before you go back to Alaska? And
I don't know what Mother said, but she came back in, and Grandma said, well, what's the matter? And Mother told her, and she said, well, Lou, you're certainly going to go down. And Mother said, oh, she said, I couldn't. She said, Mother had white hair after the fire. Her hair was perfectly white. I couldn't go down and spoil their illusions of some beautiful young widow, you know, going back up to marry the rich fellow. So, in 1921, Mother and four children went into Seward, and Major McFarland and Mother were married. I don't remember who the priest was down there in Seward. Then, I forgot to tell you. On the way down, from after Father died, on the way down to Seward to get the boat out to go to Boston, we took the train, the Alaska Railroad, from Fairbanks down to, not quite Nenana.
Denmark.
Because there's no bridge across the river. And it was in March. And the ice, the river was, breaking up. I mean, it was thawing the center. So we had to walk out on the ice and get in a little rowboat and row across this open part and then cross the ice and crawl up the big bank into Nenana. And the wind was terrific. It blew us off our feet. So Mother had a friend by the name of Barney Dawson meet us, and he took one little girl in his arm and me. And the other one walked with Mother. And we got in this little rowboat and started across this open face of water. And one of the men in the back fell out. And they shrieked, man overboard. And the men with the rowboat and with the oar said, we can't help it. We have women and children in this boat. And there was a big sheet of ice moving down this open part of the channel. And we had to get across before this thing sliced us right in two. So we dragged the fellow across in his coonskin coat, and Mother and the three little girls and a rowboat full of people, and got back. And then from Nenana the train went so far. Well, and on the way back, it was the reverse. And I remember at Hurricane Gulch, that big trestle wasn't built yet. And the place is well named, I assure you. My little sister, Frances, I was about nine by that time. Frances must have been about seven. We had to walk up this big long hill to get up the top to get a sled of some kind or something. Maybe this is the only way, because it's winter time. And Frances was all bent over and carrying something. And Mother said, honey, what are you carrying? And she says, she opened her arms up and she had a rock, a big rock. And she says, I'm going to blow away. Carrying this big rock. So we got up at the top of the hill. This must have been the way down. And then took a sled for I don't know how many miles. Another double ender. And then got the train again down to Seward. Now coming back, it was the same thing, only this time it was in the summertime. And my stepfather was the superintendent of the telephone and telegraph lines at Anchorage. So we lived there for about a year, I guess. And then in 1922, either the office closed or something. Anyway, he was out of a job, and we moved out to California. Santa Cruz, it's south of San Francisco, and I never in my life was as cold as I was down there. It's a resort town, and we lived on the ocean. We had to get a cheap little house. And they're not prepared for cold weather down there, so we just froze all the time. In 1923, we were back in Alaska. My father got a job as the park ranger at McKinley Park, and so he came back up and got established at McKinley, and on December 23rd, we were all together again at McKinley Park for Christmas. Harry Carstens was the superintendent then. He was he had been known, probably he was then at the time, known as the 40-mile kid. Now, I used to know what that meant, but I can't remember now. Anyway, he was one of the men who took one of the first American parties up to Mount McKinley. By 1924, Dad was out of a job again,
and back in Fairbanks. This time he was on as dispatcher of the railroad here in Fairbanks with Mr. Jennings was the boss at the this office here. And here I attended Maine School for the second time. And I know you're just thinking I'm going to tell about my little boyfriend, but I'm not going to. Now, some of the people that I went to school with at this time are Josephine King, Henry Quirk, Bill Lavery, Oscar Bradley, Charlotte, and Charlotte Werner, and she had a younger sister, I can't think. And then there's a woman here in town, a Mrs. Herring. I can't remember. What's her name? Do you know Miss Alma? What was her other her maiden name? And there's
the
another.
Undertaker. What was his name? The old Undertaker.
Rossi.
Rosie
Ross.
Alma
Ross.
Gosh, I can't remember. She knows me, but I. And there are others, but that's been a long, long time ago, and I can't remember that. Then my sisters were friends with the Egan girls and the Miller family, Josephine and Mary and Bill and Emma, who is Mrs. Vasquez. No, it was Vasquez, yes. And a very, very close friend of the family was Mrs. Pedro. She always dressed like a man, with a high collar and a black tie and a hat. We call them a sailor hat, you know, the high crown and very, and she's very, very businesslike, very mannish. And I guess she had to be to keep her property down there where Felix discovered gold, because they were always after her, trying to do her out of it. And in the end, she lost it. But I remember one time she was telling Mother that there was the men that were working for her didn't want to work under a woman, and least of all Mary Pedro. And so there was going to be some kind of trouble. And somehow or other, Mrs. Pedro heard about it, and they sent a man in just to demand something. So she said she pulled open the desk drawer when she saw him coming, and she brought out a huge wrench, and she laid it on the table, and she said, "Yes, now what did you want?" And he just fell all apart, you know, and made some kind of flimsy little excuse and ran. So she saved herself that time. Father P.J. O'Reilly was the pastor here at the time. If you don't know Father O'Reilly, your education isn't complete. Typically Irish, and he had no time for me. He told me one time that I would never turn out to be worth a damn. I don't know what I did that day. Terrible. Mr. Pascal was the superior. There is a memorial window for my father in the church. It's the second from the back on the right-hand side as you've been in the front door. Let's see now. Oh, then in 1926, the fall of 1926, Mother and Dad decided that I should go outside the school. There was a little incident happened in the grade school here that they didn't blame the school organization, but they didn't like the little friends I had. So they talked for a long time one night, and finally I was told that I would go outside the school. And I was sent out to Providence Academy at Vancouver, Washington. It's run by the Sisters of Providence. Incidentally, it was founded in 1856 and it closed just last summer. And this time the railroad was completed, so we didn't have to trudge down Hurricane Gulf and up one side. And McFarland lost his job at the railroad here again, and somehow or other he got a job back at the Park Service in McKinley Park. And he worked there until 1932, and then by that time all the girls were out of school, and so Mother and Dad moved out. Major McFarland died in 1942. He was at the Veterans Hospital in Portland. He had an embolism and died very suddenly. My mother is still living. She's 90 years old, maybe 90 years old this June. I joined the Sisters of Providence in 1931, and that's where I found the sister for whom I had been a first baby case. Now, I should tell you something about some of the characters that we knew. There was a Coke Hill, he was a I don't know what he was. I just know that he drove a magnificent dog team. He and his wife, she drove as well as he did. And they had a pure wolf as a lead dog. A very vicious thing that couldn't even be kenneled with the rest of the dogs. He must have had about 20 dogs in his team. And we had a long kennel with, you know, individual stalls for the dogs. And Wolf, they couldn't even put him in there. They had to keep him someplace outside. And I remember one time, we never ate candy at our house. I mean, never ate chocolates, I should say that. We had all kinds of stick candy and that sort of stuff. But any chocolates came in the house, my mother ate. That was for her. So this day, somehow or other, we had a box of chocolates, and it was Sunday, and Mother gave us a chocolate. We didn't know how to eat them. We smashed them on our hand and spent the rest of the afternoon licking them. So I had eaten one, licked one, and I asked for another one, and she said, no. No. So I whined around a little bit, and finally Mother said, oh, for heaven's sake, go out doors and play. So I got all bundled up with a big long scarf, and when it was winter, and Coke Hill was here with his dogs, and Wolf was chained to the flagpole. So I was feeling real sorry for myself, sniffing around there looking at Wolf, and I heard my father just roar, and he ran up and just snatched me up off the ground, and it seemed Wolf had gotten the end of my scarf and just pulling me into him. Oh, the air was blue with cuss words that he knew, and Coke Hill had to move the wolf. So I got back in the house crying and everything else, but I got another chocolate. Smashed my hand. One day in the summertime, there was great excitement for that. Somebody, some old man who had a dog team they let run wild all summer long, you just corral them in the wintertime and then use them, came down, and the dogs had gotten run afoul of a porcupine. And they looked like pincushions. I never saw way back here in their faces, their noses, in their mouths, way back in their throats. Well, of course, Mother ushered us all in the house, and Father said, well, we'll have to chloroform. He said, we can't pull these things out like this. So they brought a table out and with the pliers and the chloroform. He got all the quills up. Some of them go way back, and they were broken in their throats and that sort of thing. And the last one left was a female dog that stood very quietly all during this thing. And Father said, gee, he said, I don't think she needs any chloroform. So he started, and he pulled one quill, and she snapped at him, and her teeth met, you know, through his hand here. Well, we came in, and Father was holding this, you know, and Mother, of course, was all jittery, so she poured peroxide into it, and he had a hole this side to keep it from running up. So there he sat all afternoon, and of course, Mother worry, and every time she went by, he'd go, she said, Johnny, don't. We didn't know what was going on. One night, there was a very interesting man came. He was called the Scurvy Kid. These people had the funniest names, nicknames, you know. The Scurvy Kid. Now, why he got that, I don't know, but this is about 1918 when the flu epidemic hit all these people, and just the Indians and the natives couldn't take it. So the Scurvy Kid took a dog team and went through all the Indian villages and picked up gunny sacks full of ivory stuff. And I remember my father called us all out. Our dining room table must have been as long as this table. And the stuff was laid out, combs and letter openers and cribbage boards and lockets and watch fobs and all kinds of stuff. And my father said, you know, girlies, he said, you can pick out something in this from here that you'd like to have. They were just lockets and things like that. And I remember each of us took something. We still have them, little lockets and that sort of thing. And Mother bought a beautiful knife. It looks as if it could have been used to cut steak. It's beautifully, it's thin and extremely sharp. And Father bought a beautiful cribbage board, a whole tusk, you know, with a little drawer missing, a team of dogs and this sort of thing. And I remember him just kind of shaking his head over the fact that these natives had spent years probably doing these things, gone now, and this kid, Scurvy Kid, just picking them up and selling them. Now, before I close, I want to tell you a true story. And I want you to go home and tell somebody else about this. We had a little tradition in our house on Christmas Eve. This was the year that my father caught Santa Claus in the bear trap. When I saw the bear trap out there in the wall, I thought, ah, here's the cycle complete. Well, this was it. We had a bath, these little tin tubs, you know. Mother used to say, every Saturday morning we had to go up and shovel snow. And she'd say, girl, please get the clean snow. And we'd shovel and shovel and shovel and shovel, and she never seemed to have enough snow for a bath water, but somehow or this time we managed. And we all had our bath. We always had a new flannel nightie for Christmas Eve, and then we said our prayers at Father's lap, and then they got out the old phonograph and wound it up and put a record on that we played only once a year. And it was a recitation of the night before Christmas, and it was very well done. So we'd listen and listen and listen, because at the very end, where the little poem goes, and I heard him exclaim as he drove out of sight, Merry Christmas to all and to all. And then you heard a little tiny voice say, good night, as if Santa Claus was way up in the sky. So we listened and listened for that. And when it was over, we made Father play that part again so we could hear, good night. And Francis said, gee, I wish we could see Santa Claus. And Johnny said, you want to see Santa Claus? Do you really want to see Santa Claus? And we said, oh, yes, we'd love to. And he said, all right, he said, I'll tell you, tomorrow morning, now when he comes, I'll put a big bear trap in front of the door, and Santa Claus will open the door and step in, and we'll catch him, and then you can see him. Well, that was just wonderful. So, we kissed Father goodnight, Mother put us to bed, and Frances and Rita went right to sleep. She must have been about three. I couldn't have been any more than about, Rita wasn't three, about two. I was about six when this happened. Frances and I talked and talked for a long time about what Santa Claus would look like and what we'd say to him, what we'd ask him for. And Frances didn't think he'd like to be caught because he never wanted us to see him. So finally she fell asleep and I went on talking. And the next morning, we kind of forgot about the Santa Claus deal. Mother and Father always had us dress first. They'd never catch us if we once got in that living room with a tree. So we went into the master bedroom where there was a stove, and we were dressing in there. Now the living room was a long, this part of the house was long. Living room and our bedroom and then the master bedroom. So Francis was sitting on the floor with putting on a little shoe that was red and black, and it had white tassels. I can see it yet. And I was pinning, I was standing up, pulling on a long black stocking. I had one of these little Paris waists on, and I was just hooking it. And Mother had Rita on a stool, and she was just putting a little starched dress on over her head, just out of this. When the front door slammed, and something went snap! And Frances stopped, and I began to flip this garter. I can feel it. Yeah. And my father came tearing into the room, and he said, Grace, come on, come on, Santa Claus is up there. And we just looked at him, and he says, well, don't you want to go and see Santa Claus? And Frances, the little one, had been very sick, and she knew what pain was. She said, I don't think I want to see him. And she began to cry. And she said, you know, it'll hurt him, and he won't come back next year. I don't think I want to see him. Well, I had never thought of that. But Jesus thought about coming back next year got me started, so I began to cry. And Rita, seeing the other two cry, just went, boo-hoo-hoo. And Mother was standing with this dress, and I can see her looking at my dad. And the face said, you lucky stiff. And he said, you girls don't want to see Santa Claus. And we just screeched, no, go with him out of the bear trap. We want him to come back next year. So he said, all right, now, I let him out. But I can't promise that I'll get him back. But if you don't want to go out and see him, all right, I'll go and let him out. Go and let him out. Mother said, for goodness sakes, Johnny, go and let him out of the bear trap. So Father went out. And she got me to quiet. Oh, listen. Pretty soon through the door slammed. And then Frances jumped up, and she went to the window, and she said, there he goes. He just went by in his sled. Now he'll come back next year. And I remember looking and looking and looking, but I couldn't see him. But I pretended I did. So, he went off after he finished dressing, and then Father was sitting tipped back, rolling a cigarette. The bear trap was on the floor, sprung, and we looked all around, and he said, "You girlies are late. Santa Claus was right here in the bear trap." Now, don't let anybody tell you there isn't a Santa Claus, because my daddy caught him in a bear trap. This is my father. I think this is taken in dog. I don't know what you call it. Is that a tin cup? And this is Tolavanna with a dog sled. That's it. And this is my father. Here he is, captain of the Dawson Fire Department. This is my mother. My father said they always should have been married when they were this. He's about a year older than she, but she's 18. She didn't marry him until 10 years later. This is their wedding picture. Oh, this is my mother now. That's taken about 1951. That's the last. Oh, would you like to hear the letter that my mother wrote after I was born? Tells about her trip. Do we have time?
Do we have all the time in the world?
All right. This was written. I was born in November 1911. This was written February 1912. And she's writing to a Mrs. McPhail in Vancouver, B.C. Mrs. McPhail had been her very dear neighbor in Dawson, and who knew the whole family and who knew the babies and Hayden and that sort of thing. So Mother says, "You will be glad to know that we have a dear little girl, dear little daughter, such a treasure. She was born November 26, 1911. I expected her around the last of the month, and I had hoped so much that she would come on the 27th. That was one of the little baby's birthday. But it was very close. It was 11:20 p.m. on a Sunday evening. I am sure you will realize what she has meant to us. Dear Mrs. McPhail, you would be terribly shocked if you knew the kind of a trail I went over to Fairbanks. We had a very light fall, a late freeze-up, and very little snow. I was really worried about getting up there, as day after day went by and no snow. I took Hayden with me, and we left here November 15th, the first stage up, and my first date for the baby's arrival was the 20th. You see, I had no time to spare, but I could not do anything different. Johnny suggested my going up on the one of the last boats, but I didn't want to be gone that long. The trail is nothing like the winter trail from Dawson. That, my dear, is a boulevard. This was terrible. Among niggerheads and all kinds of bumps, and not an inch and a half of snow. The first day was 20 miles. That's to Johnny Campbell. And truly, I held myself up in my elbows. I was so afraid. The next day was 28 miles, and no roadhouse or any place to stop for noon. I was afraid that night I would be caught there. I was so very miserable. What made it worse was a very bad cough that racked and strained me dreadfully. The next day was 28 miles to Fairbanks, but we had a stop at Esther, a town 12 miles this side of Fairbanks. We had quite an experience before we reached Esther. The mule that was pulling our rig took fright at a dog team and gave me quite a fright. The driver was able to hold him quiet a second, and you may be sure I lost no time scrambling out and getting Hayden out, too. The old mule bolted off the trail over fallen logs, and to be tipped out might have meant something serious. When we reached Esther, we finished our journey in an auto, which runs between that and Fairbanks. Wasn't I glad when we got to the hospital with those dear little sisters crowding around me, all trying to do something for me. It seemed as though we had reached a good, safe port. Well, dear, we were there only 9 days when our little daughter came. Then it was time to think of the return trip. She was 3.5 weeks old when we left there. Everyone was so worried it seemed to start out at 6 o'clock in the morning. with that little baby in a clothes basket beside me, and Hayden sitting at the other end of the sleigh. Well, we got home fine on Christmas Eve, just as we planned. It was a joyful reunion, and I was so happy to put our wee daughter in her father's arms. Isn't that dear?
Thank you, Sister Hubert. Thank you. May I ask you to read the titles on this paper heading for our records?
Peter Vachon, A.G. Vachon, and W.J. Vachon, manager. Tolavana Trading Company, General Merchants and Traders. Highest price paid for furs. Best roadhouse on the Tananaw Fairbanks Trail. Tolavana, Alaska.
February
9th, 1912.
We thank you, Sister Hubert. Yes. And this closes our recording for September the 27th, 1966, in the basement of the Chamber of Commerce building. This is a continuation of Sister Hubert's tape. We have asked her to read for the record her newspaper clippings, so what paper they were from, and read the entire article that we might have it on tape.
This is a clipping from a paper in Boston. I don't know the name of the paper. It reads this way: fire victims laid at rest. Funeral of Vachon children in Alaska. The Fairbanks, Alaska citizen of November 21st has the following account of the funeral there of the Vachon children who were burned to death, a report which appeared in the Daily Telegraph at that time. Probably the most pathetic funeral that ever occurred in Fairbanks was that which took place yesterday morning when Margaret, Josephine, and Otis Vachon, the infant children of Captain and Mrs. W.J. Vachon of Tolavana, were laid to rest. The children, aged 3 months, 2 years, and 4 years, respectively, were burned to death when the Vachon store at Tolavana was destroyed by fire on Tuesday morning. The tragedy, by far the worst in the history of the Tananaw Valley, occurred shortly after the family had finished breakfast. Neither Captain Vachon nor Mrs. Vachon were in the house at the time the fire broke out, and the upper part of the buildings where the children were at the time was a seething cauldron when Captain Vachon was able to reach the store. Without hesitation, however, he groped his way into the upper room where the children were in bed and felt for the little ones. On account of the smoke, it was impossible for him to see anything, but he was able to gather up and carry downstairs the eldest child, Hayden, and the eldest girl, Josephine. It was found that Hayden was unhurt, and he was soon restored to consciousness, but the little girl's strength had been unable to withstand the smothering of the terrible heat and smoke. Captain Vachon could hardly be restrained from making another entrance into the building, but it was seen that there was no longer hope that the other children could be alive, and he was perforce compelled to turn his energies to the saving of the other buildings. It was not until after the fire had been kept from spreading to the adjacent buildings that the captain realized that he was badly burned himself about the face and hands. Word of the tragedy was immediately wired to Fairbanks, and Dr. Poole and Peter Vachon at once started downriver, meeting Captain Vachon on his way out at Minto. Dr. Poole returned with Captain Vachon while Peter continued on to Tolavana for Mrs. Vachon and the bodies of the children. With these, he arrived in Fairbanks on Saturday. The funeral services over the three children were held at the Roman Catholic Church yesterday morning at 11:30, being conducted by the Reverend Father Cremont, assisted by Reverend Father Monroe. The church, beautifully decorated in white, was packed to the doors before the services began. The three tiny white caskets were escorted from the undertaking parlors to the church by Father Monroe and 18 little girls acting as honorary pallbearers. Entering the church, singing the hymn, "I Am But a Stranger Here," the cortege was most truly pathetic. The altar boys and Father Monroe preceded the little girls, each of whom carried large sprays of white lilies, and then came Frank Gordon, J.F. Sterling, and Max Smith, carrying the small caskets. The mourners were Mr. and Mrs. Peter Vachon and Mrs. W.J. Vachon. Captain Vachon still being confined to a hospital with his injury. After the services at the church, nearly all of the large assemblage followed the remains to the cemetery, where the short burial service was read by Father Cremont. A choir of 8 ladies rendered Batman's convent mass at the church, the soprano and alto solos being sung by Mrs. Moffat and Mrs. Caskey. The special numbers, in addition to the mass, were a duet, Hope Beyond the Veil, sung by Mrs. Roberts and Mrs. Caskey, the offertory, O Solitaris, sung by Mrs. Caskey, solo, Angels Ever Bright and Fair, rendered by Mrs. Moffat, and a solo, One Sweetly Solemn Thought, sung by Mrs. Caskey. This is a clipping from the Alaska Catholic, dated April 18, 1942. The headline reads, Peter Vachon, 1897 Stampeder, passes. Funeral services were held at Santa Monica, California recently over Peter C. Vachon, age 67, the brother of His Excellency Most Reverend Alexander Vachon, Archbishop of Ottawa, Canada, and a close friend of His Excellency Most Reverend J. R. Cremont, S.J.D.D. Mr. Vachon was born at St. Raymond near the city of Quebec and was one of 13 children. In 1897, he joined the Stampede to Dawson in Yukon Territory. He started a merchandising business in Fairbanks in 1904 and later established fur trading posts throughout the interior. He also had mining properties in Alaska and real estate holdings in Seattle. Mr. Vachon is survived by his widow, 2 daughters, Constance and Hortense of Santa Monica, and a son, David Vachon of Los Angeles, also 4 brothers and 2 sisters.
Thank you, Sister Hubert. This picture of your mother, you tell us she's still alive. Where is she now?
Well, she's in a nursing home, Jim, in Eugene. Eugene, Oregon, and she'll be 90.
19 years old, isn't that wonderful?
Mm-hmm. And she's always had white hair like that.
Yeah.
I never have known her any other way. I think after the babies were lost, I think this came on very quickly.
That's right. Well, it's been very delightful having you, Sister Hubert.
Thank you very much.